Welcome to the supplemental audio commentary for Thunderball. I am John Cork of the Ian Fleming Foundation. This audio commentary track was compiled by Paul Scrabo and produced by Twine Entertainment and MGMUA Home Entertainment. I will be your guide as we hear from many of the people who created Thunderball, including the late director Terrence Young, underwater director Rico Browning, production designer Ken Adam, special effects designer John Steers, composer John Barry, stars Luciano Paluzzi, Molly Peters, Martine Beswick, and many others involved with the film. On analog track number 2, editor Peter Hunt and screenwriter John Hopkins discuss their memories of Thunderball. It is important to note that these stories have been gathered 30 years after the making of the film, and these recollections are not meant to be the definitive history of the movie. Thunderball was the fourth James Bond film, and due to the unparalleled interest in Secret Agent 007 during 1965, it became one of the most eagerly awaited films in history. With four-unit shooting, Thunderball became a precursor to the larger action extravaganzas which have followed. On top of it all, Thunderball is a very good movie, with a clever screenplay which avoids the obvious choices. It is a film filled with surprises, style, and engaging characters. First, we will hear from Rose Alba, the actress who is intentionally obscured from view during this funeral scene. Rose Alba was a dancer and an actress, starting in the mid-50s, launching her film career with Shadow of a Man as a cabaret singer. She appeared in many British television shows during the 60s, including a part opposite Roger Moore in The Saint.
My name is Rose Alba. The director, Terence Young, was up in the organ loft, and I was wearing a hat with a veil to partly obscure my features, and there were live candles all around the coffin because I was a sorrowing widow. So I stood there with my veil and my hat, and there were the live candles, and there was a draft coming through the door. So Terence Young said, "Rose, get closer to the candles." So I said to myself, "If I get any closer, my face will go up in flames." Then I walked out of the chapel, floated up the stairs, to meet Sean Connery, James Bond. And the next moment, surprise, surprise, I've gone.
Indeed, Rose Alba has gone, replaced by stunt coordinator extraordinaire Bob Simmons as Spectre agent Jax Beauvoir. We are now into James Bond's world, where nothing is what it initially seems, a motif for 007 film openings. In Dr. No, blind men are really assassins, and in From Rush with Love, Bond himself is just a masked clay pigeon being tracked by killer Red Grant. In Goldfinger, an oil storage tank holds a gloriously lush heroin lab. This fight showcases Bob Simmons' skill as a stunt arranger. Major pieces of furniture fly about the room. Everything becomes a weapon, making the violence seem larger than life. Ultimately, the screenwriters allow Bond to do exactly what he came to do. By throwing flowers, Bond does offer his condolences to the man who was supposed to be, and now actually is, dead. But of course, it's not over yet. Meet Burt Luxford, who worked with John Steers' special effects team, as he discusses the technical aspects of Bond's daring escape.
My name's Burt Luxford. That jetpack which he's got on there is the one I made. That is the proper one you see going up in the air, but there's a pilot in charge of that there. It's obviously a very dangerous thing to use. The actual jets that came out were CO2, they weren't the proper jets. They're just far faster, too dangerous for any actor to use. In fact, the pilot came over with the pack, and when I hired it in the workshop, he was with it all the time, he wouldn't let it go. The jets of water coming out the back, it was a specially rigged thing. It wasn't on the car all the time. Two tubes were linked in the front to a quick-release coupling from a 3-inch fire engine hose. And it was the actual fire engine that pumped the water through the car and out the back. Because obviously they couldn't have that much water on the car. There wasn't room to sit in it, let alone have a big tank, you know. So that's why you never actually see it running.
It is time to introduce the director of this nonstop action, Terrence Young, who also directed the first two Bond films, Dr. No and From Rush with Love. Thunderball was his last Bond film, and in an interview taped in 1974, Terrence Young talks about how he became involved in the James Bond juggernaut.
Well, it was a strange thing. I was about to make a picture with Ava Gardner, whom I'd known for some time. We'd never worked together. In fact, the first time I made a film with her was about 10 years later on Myling, 8 years later, anyway. And I received a cable while I was in Rome from the producers, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman, saying, would you be free and prepared to do a film on one of the James Bond books? So I sent back a cable and I said, I'm happy and willing to start, in fact, very enthusiastic, provided that the book that they film for me shall be one of the three following: Thunderball, From Russia with Love, or Dr. No. Now, by a real coincidence, those are the three Bond films I made, but in the reverse order. And as it so turned out, I was wrong, because Thunderball was an immensely expensive picture. And if we'd started the series with Thunderball, I think it would have been poorly made, it would have been skimped, it would have looked cheap, and we'd never have been able to make it properly. So I think the miracle was that we started with Dr. No, which was the most modest in production conception. And also, I think, in a funny way, the story lended itself best of all to setting the tone of what was going to be the whole series. My feeling, I have no inhibitions talking about my own work. I made some very fine films, I made some very bad films. I thought Dr. No was the most interesting in some ways, because it was the first, and we created a character, we gave the whole series a tone, a color. I think From Russia with Love was the best of all the Bond films, and Thunderball was the most successful. All my three Bond films are similar. What was different was the modus operandi. When I made Dr. No, I had $1 million. When I made From Russia with Love, I had $2 million. When I made Thunderball, I had $9 million. And after that, everybody says, why don't you make any more? And I said, well, why should I? I've done it.
Young unfortunately passed away in 1994. He was an Irishman by blood and was born in the international sector of Shanghai in 1915. Terrence Young traveled extensively in his youth, learning many languages and picking up many urbane attitudes. During World War II, Young served in the Irish Guards Tank Division and also wrote screenplays, including a co-writing credit on Secret Mission, which was filmed in 1942. By 1948, Young graduated to directing with One Night With You. He directed 15 films before helming Dr. No, including producer Albert Cubby Broccoli's first film with Alan Ladd, The Red Beret. One of the universal comments from those who worked with Terrence Young is that he embodied so much of James Bond. Young's taste in finely tailored clothes, champagne, and all the elegant accoutrements, which are so important to James Bond's world, gave him a larger-than-life quality. His erudite wit and sophisticated sense of drama made him a perfect choice to create a filmic James Bond. Young made many important contributions. First, he never skimped on style. He knew James Bond was as much about choosing the right Savile Row tailor as he was about espionage. Second, he realized that while Fleming did not put a great deal of humor in his writing, Fleming's style was so breezy and sardonic that the books were amusing to read. Terrence Young understood how to transform this amusing style into cinematic humor with throwaway lines and sexual innuendo. With these trademarks, James Bond would become the model of the 60s Renaissance man, a confident, libidinous, expert on everything, who had permission to break all of society's rules. More on Terrence Young later. Let's meet the man who created this amazing set, Ken Adam. Born in Berlin in 1921, Ken Adam is arguably the most important production designer in film history. His innovative sets stretch from the amazing modern concoctions of the Bond films to Dr. Strangelove, to the impeccable period sets for films like Barry Lyndon and The Madness of King George, both of which earned Adam Academy Awards. Adam got his start in films working on Around the World in 80 Days, which also boasted another important member of the Thunderball crew, producer Kevin McClory. Later, Adam worked with Cubby Broccoli on The Trials of Oscar Wilde. The scene playing here is a stylized version of the scene which appears in the novel, Thunderball, where Blofeld electrocutes a Spectre member for raping a young female kidnap victim. Here, the bold metallic set makes the villain seem all the more dangerous, cold, and ruthless. Also, Adam takes Fleming's scene one step further, making a vital contribution.
I always felt by this time that a Bond needed that sort of moving set, really, so that it didn't just become a tableau, but that things happened in that set. And so the disappearing chair was part of it, and it also was quite funny. I did a lot of sketches for that because I used to design also the boardroom table and find or design the chairs they'd had. So I wasn't satisfied with the first sketches I did until I finally came up with that.
Ken Adam's ability to go from one design style to another was vital for the Bond films. Adam had to feel comfortable with an ultra-modern set as well as more traditional and classical styles. This seamless flow from one impeccably designed set to another helps establish the air of sophistication, which is so important in these films.
South of England, where he's making the necessary preparations. He is at a health clinic, conveniently located.
Here at Shrublands, we are introduced to one of Terence Young and writer John Hopkins' techniques for showcasing information. Count Lippi tells Bond, "I see you've noticed that too," referring to the attractive Nurse Fearing. But Young, Hopkins, and editor Peter Hunt used the line to highlight Count Lippi's tattoo on his wrist. In other places in Thunderball, writer Hopkins gives Bond similar throwaway lines to foreshadow events or act as counterpoint. This style of dialogue adds to Bond's mythic stature. Hopkins' skill in this area helps lift Thunderball above many similar films, giving even simple lines an air of importance and depth. Another major contributor to the action at this point is Sean Connery, who had become good friends with director Young. Connery has the ability to make the most innocuous lines sound clever and witty. By Thunderball, director Young and Connery had fun with this, making obscure references to inside jokes in the dialogue. Their camaraderie was based on deep respect, as Terence Young remembers.
He's a marvelous person. He's completely honest. He's fundamentally honest, a little too honest. I like him inordinately as a man. I think as a man, he's even more impressive than he is as a public figure on the screen. He's a really, really splendid person. He's had a tough life. He came from a very poor family, and he remembers it. He's not mean. He's bought me some really very extravagant presents and all that. But when you go out for dinner one night, and he looks at the bill, he says, "My God," he said, "my whole family could have lived on this for a week." And he's gone up to saying, "You know, my family could have lived on this for a month." So I think that's the change in the right and the cost of living these days. But he's a very, very fine person in every sense.
Sean Connery did indeed come up from a family of very few means in Scotland. His quest to build a different life for himself and educate himself is an amazing success story. But Connery's continued interest in his roots is well documented, having contributed millions of dollars to Scottish charities, including donating his entire salary from his last United Artists Bond film, Diamonds Are Forever. Molly Peters, who appears coming up, is one of the most engaging actresses to be in a Bond film. She was discovered by Terence Young after appearing as an extra in The Amorous Adventures of Moll Flanders.
Well, I'm Molly Peters. I played Patricia Fearing in Thunderball. Physiotherapist, or physical therapist, as someone said. Well, my son, when he first saw it, he was very small and thought that every blonde on a Bond film was his mother. But then as he got older, and he's now 21, he takes the mickey, makes fun of what I do in this film. And for instance, there's a scene where he mimics me.
Behave yourself, Mr. Bond.
Oh, that's it. My son goes, oh, Mr. Bond, Mr. Bond. And laughs at me.
Molly Peters had an unfortunately short career of only two major films, The Amorous Adventures of Moll Flanders and Thunderball. A dispute with her agent prevented her from capitalizing on her success in Thunderball. She started out as a model, a figure model as they were referred to in those days, posing in rather tame nude photographs. A featured role in Thunderball was quite a step for her, but she has fond memories of working with Sean Connery.
At first being awed by this man, because he was becoming very well known anyway and had already, completed three Bond films, I think, for me, he was a very honest, straightforward man, and he didn't suffer fools gladly. He would seemingly get things done. Again, he was very protective. I remember particularly that I had had some personal problem, and we were just about to do the bed scene, or one of the scenes on the bed, and I can't remember which. And I had had this particular problem, and I started crying because I was very upset. He thought someone had upset me on the film set and came up and put his arm around me and said, who is it? Who did that? Or who said something to you? Tell me what it is. And I said it was personal, but he was very protective and very kind after that. But he seemed to think someone had been nasty on the set. I do value that. I think he was great. The sets amazed me here in Pinewood. The whole atmosphere to me was new, exciting. I remember that fluffing my lines really badly. And I think I say something about going to the shower, it will shrink you back to size. And all I kept coming out with was, it'll stretch you back to size. I mean, it was so stupid. It was just one word, and I fluffed and fluffed and fluffed the thing, and I got into quite a panic. We cleared the set for this, for the shower scene, because I appear to be naked in the shower. Sean kept fooling around during those scenes. It was quite funny. He did a Groucho Marx walk. So come out of the shower and walked as Groucho Marx used to walk.
See you later, alligator.
This whole Shrubland sequence is very similar to the novel Thunderball, including the roasting of Count Lippe here. In earlier drafts of the script, Bond talked to Lippe in a mock Cockney accent to disguise his identity. He also had various exit lines. In one version, saying to Lippe, "If you catch fire, you can sue." In a later draft, Bond sings, "We're having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave."
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Now, don't you worry. I'll tell the chef.
This version was created on the set between Connery and director Young and allows Bond to be more efficient and cool in his revenge.
Mink. It reduces the tensions.
Not mine.
Italian actress Luciana Paluzzi plays the villainess of Thunderball. She decided to go into films at the age of 15 when she got a walk-on role in Three Coins in the Fountain.
My father wanted me to become a teacher. I wanted to become a naval engineer. And none of this happened because I went on a set and I said, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. Yes. So my father was very upset. I worked in Italy for about a year, and then I was brought over to England to star in a movie called Sea Fury with Victor McLagan, Stanley Baker. Anyway, it was for rank. And then I did another one with Terry Thomas called The Man with the Cocked Hat. And I did one for Terrence called No Time to Die. That's how I met Terrence. After those three pictures, I was brought to United States to do a test. Actually, they saw a test I did, and they brought me in to do a television series called Five Fingers. And they put me under the contract. And the series lasted only one season. because he was against the two top-rated series of the time, which were Gunsmoke and F Gun Will Travel. And we were the first hour series on the air at the time. It was very unusual to have an hour. And we were smack against the two of them on Saturday night. So we lasted for a year, but that was it. And so I went back to Europe and I started to work there again. Terence, he was the one that wanted me to do Thunderball. And he was the one that had me brought in to test for it.
Luciana Paluzzi, like hundreds of other actresses, tested for the part of Domino, who was originally written as an Italian. She seems a natural for the role of Fiona Volpe, and indeed played this type of part many times. She worked for Terence Young again in 1974's The Klansman, in which her voice was dubbed. She retired from acting in 1980, but remained very close with Terence Young. When Paluzzi married television executive Michael Solomon, Terence Young walked her down the aisle. She also remained in touch with Sean Connery and later became friends with Roger Moore, once having the two James Bonds over to dinner at her Beverly Hills home. Her husband claims he first fell in love with her when he saw a still of her astride a motorcycle from Thunderball. Guy Dolman, who plays Count Lippi, is a well-respected character actor. He appeared as a young detective in Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder and also in the post-apocalypse drama On the Beach. He had a reoccurring role in producer Harry Saltzman's Harry Palmer series, playing in both The Ypres File and Funeral in Berlin. He is recognizable to United States soap opera fans and has appeared in many TV movies and miniseries. Greek actor Paul Stasino, who plays the double role of Domino's brother Major Durval and his Spectre replacement Angelo, is another respected character actor, appearing in two Haley Mills films, Tiger Bay and The Moonspinners, as well as the James Bond spoof Where the Spies Are. He is seen in such films as Exodus, The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, and A Boy 10 Feet Tall. He also appeared with many Bond film veterans, including Roger Moore, in the 1979 film Escape to Athena. Paul Stasino's first film, Ill Met by Moonlight, also has an odd connection to Ian Fleming, James Bond's creator. This 1956 Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger film is based on a true story of British soldiers who kidnap a German general from a Greek isle during World War II. A close friend of Ian and Anne Fleming's, Major Patrick Lee Fermor, led the daring raid and wrote the book upon which the film was based. He became a noted author of adventure and travel books, including one on the Caribbean, The Traveler's Tree. In the James Bond novel Live and Let Die, Fleming has Agent 007 consult The Traveler's Tree, in which Patrick Lee Fermor writes glowingly of Ian Fleming's home in Jamaica. Lee Fermor was one of many adventurous spirits Fleming knew and admired, and who, in small ways, inspired parts of the character of James Bond.
To drive you mad. Unless, of course, it's that mink glove of yours.
I'll, shut up the noise.
Bill Sawyer, one of the men carrying in the stretcher with Count Lippi, has been one of the most daring stuntmen in England, particularly notable as Clint Eastwood's double in Where Eagles Dare, a film where many remember him for the amazing cable car sequence, which was done without protective harnesses. A little background before we hear about Sawyer's work on Thunderball. Sawyer started out as a trapeze artist, catching his fellow team members after somersaults and twists. As his job required, Sawyer developed an iron-fisted grip, which has brought more than one unsuspecting person shaking his hand to their knees. Sawyer is, in fact, as the cliché goes, a very gentle person, who had a very rough day's work with Sean Connery on Thunderball.
So I received a phone call one evening from Bob Simmons, who was then coordinator on the Bond movies. And he requested I do a window job on Thunderball. He said, "Well, we're going to do 6 takes at least, you know, Bill, get it right." Oh, I said, no, Bob, you're getting 1. This is a forehead smash, 18-inch glass. And, of course, with a shot like this, in the background, behind the glass, you look for a target, and you go for that, not the window. But make sure you hit the window dead center, hit the glass dead center. Luckily, I got through Sean gave me a nice tug, and with my thrust as well, I got through fairly well. And on landing on the windowsill, I felt this pain in the left eye, and the blood started rolling down my cheek and down the radiator. And Sean now is getting excited. He said, are you all right, Bill? Did you cut your face? Are you all right? I said, I'm okay. Sean, just finish your shot. Wrap the cord round my neck, pat my head, leave the room. Luckily, a surgeon was standing by in hospital. They took me there right away. When I came back, the chauffeur took me in the bar, and Sean was sitting with the double brandy. He said, that'll put you right. Had the brandy, and the driver took me home. And, all I can say is I found Sean a very great guy to work with in every way. He was very considerate, very caring. He cared about the stuntman, which he always did do. He always considered the stuntman working and shot with him, you know. And in this case, I did appreciate it very much. And every time I've seen Sean since then, he's always shouted, "How's the eye, Bill? You still got the eye?" And you're right.
It's funny you should say that.
Thunderball began as an idea for a film, which Ian Fleming eventually turned into a novel. In Fleming's original story outline, the atomic bombs were stolen from a NATO base. Producer Kevin McClory and screenwriter Jack Whittingham suggested the in-flight takeover, which appeared in Fleming's novel. This was before the first hijacking of a commercial airliner, although the idea was similar, in some ways, to a 1939 Laurence Olivier Ralph Richardson film, Q-Planes, released in the United States as Clouds Over Europe, and written by none other than the same Jack Whittingham, who worked with Fleming and McClory on the original Thunderball story. The crash landing of the Vulcan bomber proved to be a difficult sequence for special effects supervisor John Steers.
Thunderball was a totally different type of picture to what we'd done before. A lot, as you know, was done in the Bahamas. That's where I did the actual landing of the Vulcan bomber. This I did with an overhead rig, which was, and the model, which was 13 feet wingspan, was suspended underneath it on three wires. And it went down what we call a skate, which is held on the top three wires, and the angle was worked out right, so it makes the right approach to the water. And I worked it out. I think it was something like about a third of a mile, the two towers apart. And the towers, one was about 60 feet high, one end, and the other was about 15 feet high, the other end. And I used to go out to the Bahamas weekends, because we were filming at Pinewood at the time, and I used to get the last plane on Friday night, go out there, and then come back on Sunday night back to Pinewood. And I did that for about a month or so. Anyhow, I'd left the guys out at work and told them what I wanted, and I went out this weekend, and I couldn't believe it, because nothing was happening. The towers hadn't been worked on, and I said to the rig, I said, "What's the problem? You know, why isn't things happening?" So we can't work out there, John. So I said, "Well, why is that?" He said, "The place is full of sharks." Oh, I said, "Give me a break." I said, "There's only about 6 feet of water out there. It's high tide," I said, "and that's why we're there." I said, "It goes down to 2 feet at low tide." I said, "You know, you can work in low tide, surely, if there are sharks." I said, "But there's not sharks." So John and I said, "Well, come on, John, we'll go out there and we'll take a shark gun with us, and if we see a problem, we'll tell the guys, you see." So Joe and I are sitting on top of this tower, and the guys are working, and we're talking about things, the picture and so forth, what we're going to do. And Joe said, "I didn't realise there was rocks around here." I said, "No, there's no rocks around here, Joe." I said, "It's all sand." "Well, there's a big rock down there." So I said, "Where?" And I said, "No, that isn't a rock." I said, "It's a lemon shark. It's about 14 feet long. Swimming around the tower." So I said to the guys, come over here, I want to talk to you. So I got the guys out of the water, didn't let on that there was a shark down there. I said, "I think we'd better work at low tide only, and I think you get more work done that way." So So they agreed on that. I put him on other things to do, and we got the job done. But it turned out that that particular part of the coast is notorious for where the sharks have their young. It was their breeding season, and when we actually shot the stuff, it was a night shot, and we had to knock some bits of scaffolding tubing into the crust of the sand to get some shivers attached to them. And as we were knocking, we were suddenly aware that we had company, and we had a whole shoal of barracuda. So when we did that shot, we were actually shooting that with sharks and barracuda.
One person who had to learn to swim with the sharks literally was underwater director Riku Browning. Browning got his start playing the title role in The Creature from the Black Lagoon. He was the man in the creature costume. Browning formed a lasting relationship with producer Ivan Torres, cameraman Lamar Bourne, and underwater engineer Jordan Klein. This team worked together on the highly successful television series Sea Hunt and Flipper, which Riku Browning created.
Hi, my name is Riku Browning. We were shooting the underwater portion of just the doors opening up, and we had these doors built by the English crew attached to the working vessel that we were on, and we just manipulated the doors open and closed, and they swam up beside the vessel we were working on. This was when the pilot went down and he was caught in the aircraft. His seatbelt wouldn't open, and the heavy comes down and gives him a knife blade. John McLaughlin, who lives in Fort Lauderdale near where I live, doubled for this sequence as the heavy, and looked very much like Adolfo, and did an excellent job. Willie Myers, a gentleman from Nassau, played the part in the aircraft, and he was in no danger. He had a reserve bottle sitting right beside him. This aircraft, we hired a crane. I think it cost around $5,000 a day to lower that plane in the water so it wouldn't break up. And the plane was built on scaffolding, and it looked very real. The submarine was designed by Jordan Klein, and he was also one of the cameramen on Thunderball. And he built all of these vehicles up in Ocala, Florida, transported them to Nassau, and we used them in the film and had very little trouble with them. The bomb bay of the aircraft did work, and it was open, and there were winches that lowered the bombs the English crew had built, and they lowered the bombs perfectly. We didn't have any problems at all. And we had a crew of about 20 people on a permanent basis underwater. Two cameramen, three assistant cameramen, a director, assistant director, and then mostly divers. And then as the show expanded, when we got into the fight sequences, we hired more divers from dive clubs in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and areas close by, Nassau, to utilize them in the other scene. The smaller vessels, vehicles that Jordan built, worked very well. We used it for pulling nets over the Vulcan bomber, and then we used them in the battle sequence later on. We had trouble sometimes keeping the batteries charged because we only had two sets, and they didn't give us a full day's work, so we had to be careful when we were using the submarine so that we didn't waste battery power. The guns that were mounted on the vehicles, the small submarines and the larger submarine, were all actual working guns, and we had to be very careful nobody got hurt. We did have a couple of accidents later on in the show. We were working in about 50 to 54 feet of water where the bomber was sunk. And the water at that end of the island was much calmer that time of the year. And we had very little weather problems. I'd say we lost 3 or 4 days out of 3 months shooting. underwater. The sharks that we used in the film were captured by the Miami Seaquarium catch boat, which we hired, and they would catch sharks and put them in their well, which was inside their ship, and they'd bring them to a pen that we had built to put the sharks in, and we'd let them go inside the pen. However, we'd put a rope on their tail so that when we were ready to use them, all we had to do was get a hold of the rope, slow them down, and then you'd take three or four men to swim in, grab the shark by the dorsal and the pectoral fins, and one guy grabs the tail, and they have a little fight on their hands for a few minutes until the shark loses some oxygen and he slows down, and then we bring him into the scene and you let him go and you hope he goes in the right direction. And if he doesn't go in the right direction, you have to recapture the same way you got him the first time and bring him back in and let him go again. And eventually you get the shot.
Thunderball was the first Bond film shot in the Panavision widescreen format, which was part of an effort to create an epic look and feel for this film. Many films were copying the style set by the first three Bond adventures, so it was decided to give Thunderball a grander scope. Part of the influence for this decision rests with producer Kevin McClory. McClory began as a boom swinger, the man who operates the boom microphone, on film sets. He worked on John Huston's The African Queen and later managed securing the foreign locations on Mike Todd's Around the World in 80 Days. McClory worked on the original idea for Thunderball with Ian Fleming and two of Fleming's friends, Ivar Bryce and Ernest Cuneo. McClory, a native of Ireland, formed a partnership with Ivar Bryce, called Xanadu Films, to produce a film called The Boy and the Bridge, which McClory directed. The film was the official British entry into the Venice Film Festival in 1959, but was not well received by audiences or critics. During this time, McClory helped develop many of the story ideas which would become Thunderball, working with noted British screenwriter Jack Whittingham. McClory urged the use of extensive underwater action and suggested the filming in Nassau, where he and his wife, Eris Bobo Segrist, had a home. There were even discussions about building a film studio in Nassau to produce movies under the Xanadu banner. McClory originally wanted to produce Thunderball in a widescreen format called Todd AO, which had been developed by Michael Todd, the director of Around the World in 80 Days. McClory also originally wanted to use celebrity guest stars and showcase the Bahamian and underwater locations in much the same travelogue fashion as Around the World. Ultimately, Fleming and Bryce tired of the project, losing some confidence after the failure of The Boy and the Bridge to draw significant audiences. In January 1960, Fleming went to Jamaica and wrote the novel Thunderball, even while Whittingham and McClory were working on a script. A year later, when the novel was published, McClory sued Bryce and Fleming for using much of his material without compensation. About the same time, producer Harry Saltzman took an option on the Bond novels and, unable to find financing on his own, became partners with Albert R. Broccoli. Broccoli originally approached Columbia Pictures with a James Bond package. Columbia Pictures passed, and Broccoli contacted United Artists. UA agreed to finance a Bond film for $1 million. Thinking Fleming would prevail in any lawsuit, Broccoli and Saltzman worked with Richard Maybaum to create a screenplay for Thunderball. By late summer of 1961, everyone realized that Thunderball would be tied up in court for some time. The case went to trial in late 1963, after James Bond was already proving to be a hot film property with the success of Dr. No and From Russia with Love. Eventually, Bryce, who was paying for the lawyers, chose to settle, and Fleming granted McClory the film rights to the novel Thunderball. Producers Broccoli and Saltzman did not want Kevin McClory to produce a James Bond film which would compete with theirs, so a deal was worked out. Thunderball would follow Goldfinger, and Kevin McClory would produce the film. Very little of the specific material we have seen thus far is from the screenplays McClory developed. Shrublands is Fleming's invention, as is the assassination of Count Lippe by a fellow Spectre agent. All of the early material with Spectre is absent from the Whittingham screenplays, where the villains were mafia operatives. But little details from McClory and Whittingham do creep in. The aerial hijacking of the Vulcan bomber, the cutting of Angelo's air hose in the cockpit of the submerged Vulcan, and the entire subplot of using Angelo to double for Domino's brother, Major Derval. Also, the character of Fiona Volpe is an addition of sorts. She does not appear in the novel, but similar characters do appear in the Whittingham screenplays. We are now in one of Ken Adams' fascinating sets. Originally, this boardroom was to be filled with recognizable faces of top television and film spies. The joke was deemed too over the top, and the logistics proved insurmountable, so the idea was dropped. There is one interesting addition to the 00 agents in this room, although not clearly shown in the film. The third seat is occupied by a female 00 agent, the first, and at this time, the only female 00 in a Bond film. Bond himself is sitting naturally in the seventh seat from the door. The voice on the tape recording is character actor Eric Pullman, who provided the voice of Blofeld in both Thunderball and From Russia with Love. A little about the actors in this room. Roland Culver, who plays the dour foreign secretary, should be familiar to British film fans, having appeared in over 40 films, including the 1934 Michael Powell film COD and 1942's Secret Mission, co-written by Terence Young. He is also memorable in The Macintosh Man, Legend of Hell House, and Britannia Hospital. Roland Culver passed away in 1984. Bernard Lee, who plays M in all the Bond films through Moonraker, was born in 1908 and died during the shooting of Few Eyes Only. Lee appeared in over 80 films and television shows in his career, beginning with The Double Event in 1934. Because of his stern on-screen demeanor, he often played police detectives or military officers. Outside of the role of M, he is best remembered for playing Sergeant Payne in Graham Greene's The Third Man, directed by Carol Reed. Guy Hamilton, director of Goldfinger, also worked on The Third Man as an assistant director. Bernard Lee also worked on notable films such as John Huston's Beat the Devil with Humphrey Bogart and Peter Lorre, and the successful Disney film Kidnapped, which featured Peter Finch and a very young Peter O'Toole. He also appeared in the espionage films The Spy Who Came In from the Cold and the James Bond parody Operation Kid Brother, starring Sean Connery's brother Neil Connery, as well as many Bond film alumni, including Lois Maxwell.
You'll be working with NATO, CIA.
For her part, Lois Maxwell appeared in more James Bond films than any other performer except for Desmond Llewellyn. She was born Lois Hooker and began her career as an enlisted performer for Canadian troops during World War II. But she was booted out when it was discovered she was only 17. Not wishing to return to Canada, Lois Maxwell auditioned for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and was in the same class as future James Bond Roger Moore. After the war, Maxwell traveled to Hollywood, where she won the Golden Globe as the most promising newcomer in That Hagen Girl. Maxwell appeared in many British films during the 1950s, but slowed her film work starting in 1957 in order to spend more time raising her children. On her son's second birthday, her husband suffered a double heart attack. Desperate to provide for her family, Lois Maxwell put out the word that she needed work. Terence Young responded, offering her one of the longest-running roles in film history. Lois Maxwell appeared in a number of classic films outside of the Bonds, including Stanley Kubrick's Lolita and Robert Wise's The Haunting. She also provided the voice of Atlanta Shore in Gerry Anderson's television show, Stingray.
Good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Smashing figure. I don't suppose that has anything to do with your request.
Was there ever a man more misunderstood?
Now, James, you can't pull the wool over my eyes. You may be able to con the old man, but I know better.
With Bond now sent to Nassau, the main story of Thunderball begins. Unlike Dr. No and From Russia with Love, Terence Young skips over shots of Bond walking through international airports and meeting his contacts. In the case of Thunderball, Bond was to originally arrive via an early hang glider, an idea which was used later in Live and Let Die. Instead, Young cuts to the world which will occupy so much of this film. Riku Browning discusses shooting this scene and working with the stars.
We shot the beauty scenes on a reef that was called Goulding Key. It's a beautiful reef. It's fairly shallow. It's about 15 to 20 feet deep. And we had a scene with James Bond and his girlfriend, to be swimming there and having a little swim with a turtle. The turtle that we used in the film, we couldn't find one, and we went down to the marketplace where they sell fish, and they had about six turtles they were selling, and they were selling them as meat. So we just bought one of those and took him and put him in the ocean, but we gave him his freedom. We didn't have him for breakfast. The girl in the sequence, Lamar Boren, who was the cameraman on the show underwater, as well as Jordan Klein, was Lamar's wife, Evelyn. And I think it's the first time she ever doubled anybody. She did a very good job. We had a gentleman by the name of Frank Cousins that doubled James Bond and Sean. And one of the primary reasons is Sean was an excellent swimmer and could do the scenes himself. But the time limit on him being with us to shoot was limiting. So we used the double, Frank Cousins, and then we would bring Sean in to do the close-ups. And it worked out very well. Sean enjoyed diving and became a very good diver.
Terrence Young directed some of the underwater material as well, but his portions were filmed back at Pinewood Studios in England and consisted of close-ups and pickup shots to make the scenes complete.
I did nearly 5 days of underwater stuff with Sean. I learned to scuba and all that sort of nonsense. We went, built all the sets, the underwater sets, back in the studio in Pinewood. Nearly flooded the whole studio, incidentally, because we built a 30-foot swimming pool. And it was much more than that. We were shooting for nearly 3 weeks, the underwater stuff. And Sean did all the close stuff. That was Sean, all right. And he did it very well. He was quite a good underwater a diver, you know, scuba man. But he naturally was not able to do an awful lot of the very clever, elaborate stuff they were doing. Also because some of it was shot at about 60, 70 feet. It's not for amateurs. That's strictly for pros.
Welcome to Nassau, and one of the most lush of all the James Bond film locations. Like the best Bond locations, Thunderball showcases all the romance and elegance of the Bahamas. In 1965, Nassau was still a British colony, and very much a playground for the very rich. The island's economy was booming, and tourism from the United States soaring. Just before Thunderball film, the Beatles shot their second feature film, Help, on the island. Thus, Thunderball capitalized on Nassau's resort status at just the right time and featured the upscale ambience better than any tourist brochure. Attractive tan extras fill out the scenes at the beach or at the pool, and the weather is always sunny and the sea is always inviting. Also, at the time, the relatively new sport of scuba diving was finally becoming accessible to the casual sportsman, reaching amazing heights in popularity. What all this amounts to is the most accessible Bond film yet. Traveling to Nassau and learning to scuba dive were realistic possibilities for a large portion of the audience of Thunderball. In fact, Thunderball sent hundreds of thousands of tourists traveling to Nassau over the years. In Nassau today, one can still find cab drivers who will point out film locations 30 years later. Other cornerstones of James Bond's success are also evident in these early scenes. The filmmakers never talk down to the audience. Domino might explain that Conch Chowder is an aphrodisiac, in this, the first scene shot in Nassau, but the viewer is expected to know what conch chowder is. Bond lives in a world which requires a certain level of sophistication, but the careful viewer also gleans a certain savoir-faire just from watching the film. Aston Martin is a top-of-the-line, hand-built British sports car. Dom Perignon is a fine champagne, with 1953 and 1955 being particularly good years. The Coral Harbor is the best hotel in Nassau, and the Café Martinique, where these night scenes were filmed, is the island's most elegant restaurant. It is these sorts of bits of information which appealed to fans of the Bond novels and films and drew some viewers, particularly teenage boys, back to see Thunderball over and over. A point of trivia amid all this elegance. As Bond enters the casino, note the man with the absurd mustache blowing smoke. He is none other than producer Kevin McClory in a Hitchcockian cameo. Note the time taken with this sequence and the Bondian touches, the full shots of Bond in black tie and the evening dresses on the women. The woman who blushes as she almost runs into Bond, John Barry's seductive music. Far more time is taken with showing these types of details than showing any spycraft or espionage in this section of the film. In fact, we are never shown how Bond originally finds Domino at all, even though those scenes appeared in early drafts of the script. Those story points are skipped altogether by director Young. He spends his time, in essence, seducing the viewer, which in turn sets the mood for Thunderball's main story arc of the second act, Bond's seduction of Domino, which must occur over a three-day period. By the way, we are now back in Pinewood Studios on a set. This scene, the nearly obligatory gaming scene, is vintage Fleming and straight out of the novel, with Bond carefully taunting Largo. One note, the game so often played in the Bond novels and films, Chemin de Fer, or its cousin, Baccarat, is a game of almost pure luck. There's absolutely no gambling skill involved with the play. Adolfo Celli, who plays Largo, hails from Sicily, but has always been sensitive to the international perception of Sicilians as stock villains. In spite of this, he gained a reputation for playing the heavy in many films. At 18, Celli graduated from the Rome Academy of Dramatic Arts at the beginning of World War II. By 1950, Celli moved to South America, where he directed plays and television. Upon returning to Europe, Celli decided to focus on acting so that he could learn new directing styles. He immediately became something of a sensation, working with Jean-Paul Belmondo in That Man from Rio and Frank Sinatra in Bon Ryan's Express. He went on to play important roles in The Agony and the Ecstasy, Grand Prix, and appeared again with Sean Connery in 1977's The Next Man. He parodied his Bond connection in Operation Kid Brother in 1967. Adolfo Celli passed away in 1986. The character of Domino has a long and odd history. The original version appeared in Ian Fleming's 1959 film treatment and was called Domino Smith. She was from Scotland Yard and very similar to Fleming's character Gayla Brand from the novel Moonraker. Domino's renamed Gabby in the two Jack Whittingham screenplays and was very much a gangster's moll. Fleming adapted some of Whittingham's improvements to the character and christened her Dominetta Vitali in the novel. It turned out that Vitali is a stage name and that her real last name is Patacci, thus providing the link to the NATO pilot Giuseppe Patacci, who stole the atomic bombs. In the early drafts of the screenplay by Maybaum and Hopkins, she became Domino Palazzi. Finally, after the casting of French actress Claudine Auger, her name changed to the French-sounding Domino Derval, and her official first name changed from the Italian Dominetta to the French Dominique. This change from Palazzi to Derval came so late that the screenplay was not fully corrected, and Paul Stasino's character is called Palazzi and not Major Derval in the final credits. Claudine Auger was cast after an extensive search for Domino. After winning the Miss France title in 1958, Claudine Auger started a film career, appearing in many movies, including the British film In the French Style. After Thunderball, Auger worked with Terence Young again on Triple Cross, with Bond veteran Gert Frobe, and has starred in dozens of French and Italian films into the 1990s. Although she learned to speak English very well, because of her low European accent, she was dubbed for Thunderball. Nonetheless, Claudine Auger brings a very subtle quality to the role of Domino. She only allows the character to smile when she is in James Bond's company, and she often casts her eyes down, like an intimidated child, when Largo speaks to her. These small, careful acting choices give subtle signals to the audience that while Domino may appear free, she is a modern damsel in distress, trapped beneath the thumb of Emilio Largo, and only Bond can save her. When Domino leaves with Largo in the boat at the end of this scene, notice how Peter Hunt uses a fade-out to emphasize Domino's plight. It is the story of Domino and Bond, rather than the tale of atomic terrorism, which Fleming and the filmmakers tell in Thunderball. At the end of this scene, notice the man with the sunglasses. It is Felix Leiter, played by actor Rick Van Neuter. A careful viewer will see Bond and Leiter talking at the end of the scene. In fact, Bond and Leiter haven't met yet in the film, because editor Peter Hunt has reversed two scenes. As Bond enters the Coral Harbor Hotel, a close look at Bond's clothes will show this scene was meant to immediately follow Bond's earlier poolside scene with Domino. The scene was moved to give Largo a chance to see Bond with Domino before sending someone to kill him. The scene reversal worked perfectly for the dramatic arc of the film and shows the skill of a creative editor in improving already filmed material.
As we watch Connery move with great confidence through this scene, we can listen to Terence Young's thoughts on actors and their natural insecurities.
One always forgets how vulnerable an actor is. An actor is somebody who is standing in front of lights. He's staring into the darkness where all the crew is. He hopes to God he's doing it well. He can almost feel the air of criticism around him. I think being an actor is a lousy profession. I think they deserve all the money they get. And it's one of those marvelous, scathing things, but some of my best friends are actors. And it's a funny thing. On the whole, you'll find that unless you're intelligent and patient with actors, you're going to end up with a lousy picture. I do not have an ego problem. I remember as a young man, I worked with some very great directors. I was very lucky. I worked with René Clair. I worked with King Vidor, with Sam Wood, who I thought was the most underrated American director of all time. I thought he was a very, very fine director. I worked with Alexander Korda, who I thought was a very bad director, but he made very good pictures because he had excellent screenplays and he had very good actors. But I don't think he knew what the hell was going on half the time. I mean, he behaved much more like a referee, you know, blowing the whistle for the actors than actually directing scenes. I then worked with probably the greatest technician that we'll ever see in the cinema, who was Joseph von Sternberg. But Joe had terrible inferiority complexes and he had terrible ego problems. And his whole system of making a picture was to dominate all the actors, trying to lion tame them, you know, to treat them literally, as I say, like animals, like a lion tame, trying to make them, the animals, jump through hoops. Now, I was on a picture called I, Claudius, which was never finished, with Charles Laughton. It could have been probably one of the classics of all time. But it was ruined because of this clash of temperament, this clash of egos, because Charles didn't like being pushed around and just made it impossible. We were doing 50, 60, 70 takes a day because, von Sternberg was determined to get his own way, and Charles was equally determined that he shouldn't, and it was really childish, it was pathetic. And I said to myself then, I said, God, you know, don't you ever behave like a bloody fool like this. You've got to realize that an actor has to be cosseted, has to be helped. I mean, if an actor doesn't know his part, if he's lazy, if he's idle, then I'll lower the boom, I'll be as tough as anybody. But when an actor needs help, well, I think you should give it to him. It's as simple as that.
Small fish, working for a Mr. Largo. He's got a yacht we should take a look at later.
Welcome to Palmyra, which is actually an estate owned by one Mr. Nicholas Sullivan from Philadelphia. This house was chosen as Emilio Largo's home for many reasons, the most important being the two swimming pools, one fresh water and the other salt water. The saltwater pool was a necessity for holding the sharks, which figure so prominently in the story. In fact, it turned out to be very difficult to keep the sharks alive in the pool. Stuntman George Leach and optical effects supervisor Cliff Cully remember the particulars of filming Quist's death.
Bill Cummings, the Fred Quist, that was his name.
And it was the main job that Bill had, being eaten by the sharks.
Michael Brennan is the guy that's got hold of him there, and the other one's Tom Clegg, a big hefty stuntman with a great scar down the side, a genuine scar down the side. That's Bill in amongst the sharks. And there are the sharks, real live sharks in the swimming pool.
How did they do the shot, were they?
Well, you don't see him coming up because he's eaten. But once he hit the water, that was the end of the shot. Then they cut away to the villains, to Largo, and do the dialogue. That's the end of him. But of course, Bill had rushed out of that pool as soon as the sharks got near him. So he was out like a flash.
This set coming up. The interior of Pinder's shop was built in both Nassau as a rain set and also at Pinewood Studios for some shots which weren't filmed on location. Ken Adams' crew worked so hard at making the two sets identical that it is impossible to discern which shots were filmed where. Now for a favorite moment in any Bond film, the introduction of Q, played expertly by Welsh actor Desmond Llewellyn, who remembers shooting this sequence and remembers the part which hit the cutting room floor.
I think a lot of my irritation came from Sean's point of view of playing with the gadgets. And you know, I'd sort of say to myself, well, for God's sake, I've got to remember these awful lines, which to me never made sense. And this is the scene that they cut right at the end, which I think was a great pity. It gave Q this sort of terrific chance of dominating Bond, because at the end of the scene, Bond walks away from me, and I call him back, and he sort of comes back quite meekly. And I think that's an awful pity they cut that out. But then actors always complaining about what's left on the floor. You see, we're often inclined, actors, to think of one's own part, not the film as a whole.
Here comes one of Q's most fun gadgets, the mini rebreather, which many viewers thought was real. Riku Browning, who shot most of the footage featuring the device, discusses the handy item.
The little breathing device that he puts in his mouth was actually made with two CO2 bottles glued together and painted and a little mouthpiece put on, and it didn't actually work. Frank Cousins and Sean had to hold their breath while they were swimming with it and pretend that they were breathing. We also used that same device in the big fight sequence and used it. Now, a funny story is they do have something like that now that you can actually buy and breathe from in dive shops. And then they have the little pony tank, which they didn't used to have as well.
These shots of Bond and Leiter in the speedboat were filmed with back projection at Pinewood Studios.
A container will be dropped off the coast of Burma in the Mergui Archipelago, latitude 20 degrees north.
Lois Maxwell remembers sharing her scene with a remarkable man.
Hello, I'm Lois Maxwell. Now, there was a man in this. I think he's the one who's sitting with his back to us. His name was Charles Ruchon, and he was American Air Force. And there he is on the right. And he's the one who got all the gadgets from the United States for Thunderball. He liked to be called Mr. Vanilla. He was a wonderful, wonderful character.
I'm very much afraid we'll have to pay that price.
Sir.
Oh, yes. Signal from 007.
Charlie Ruchon enjoyed being called Charlie Vanilla because he inspired the character of the same name in the Steve Canyon comic strip. The name came from Ruchon's love for vanilla ice cream cones. Ruchon was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, but here he wears a general's uniform. Ruchon helped Broccoli and Saltzman on many Bond films, now back underwater with director Riku Browning.
Shooting at night underwater is a little more difficult than shooting in the daytime, mainly because you have to light the area just like you would on a stage or a set and shooting topside. This sequence was shot in the harbor, and we had lights coming from the prop ship, as well as lights that we used underwater, and also some backlights from the shore on the other side of the ship. This sequence was fairly easy to shoot. There wasn't a lot in it, except we had to use explosives. And they would throw these, I believe it was hand grenades, over. And we had to make it visually look like good explosions, but yet not enough explosion to hurt someone. And we experimented with those for several weeks before we found something that was suitable for that. This fight sequence around the ship was Frank Cousins and Willie Myers, who were doubles. And they had fought in other pictures that we had made before, so this was a pretty simple sequence to shoot. Lamar Boren, who shot most of the sequences in the show, was a pioneer in diving. He belonged to a little club in California called the Bottom Scratchers. And they were one of the original clubs in the United States. And Lamar built all of his own cameras. They were handmade. And he still used them all the way up until the last time I worked with him. Jordan, of course, who is the other cameraman, manufactures cameras, and his are all machine-fitted and, you know, well-made. And compared to Lamar's, they look like a Cadillac. But Lamar's worked. We had a sequence in that night sequence where Bond was supposed to be just about run over by a boat. And we had to have the boat come over and look like it was hitting tanks. And it was pretty hairy, but we were able to accomplish it. Just took our time and overcranked the camera a little. We used, on actors a lot of times, tanks that are built of fiberglass so that the weight is not so heavy on them when they're working. And it's difficult, though, for an actor to pretend that something's heavy. So a lot of times we'd use the heavy tanks up until they were too tired, then we'd put the fiberglass on them. And as you know, a scuba tank will float when it's full of air, but it'll sink when it's empty because of air waves.
Let's get back into Largo.
Coming up, James Bond meets Fiona Volpe for the first time. It is a great example of how the Bond filmmakers created a mood of danger and sexuality in a scene where very little happens. The car Fiona drives is, of course, the latest Ford Mustang. Ford provided most of the cars used by the production crew. The exterior shots of the car are a good example of day-for-night filming, using shadows of trees to make the scene look like it was shot at night. The dialogue portion of the scene was shot mainly on the back projection stage at Pinewood Studios, as Luciana Paluzzi points out.
Thank you.
Terence used love to play jokes on the set. We were shooting a scene in the car, and we were supposed to be on the road, and they had the backdrop, you know, rolling over the road, and he put the ocean behind. So we went to the dailies, and we were saying all these lines, how long is it going to be before we get whatever, I can't remember, it's so long ago. And in the back, there is no road, but there is water, and you're like in the middle of the ocean with the car. And I mean, he used to do this all the time and break up people and have them always happy on the set. There was never a tense atmosphere.
Aside from the obvious chemistry between the actors, what really brings this scene to life is John Hopkins' sparkling dialogue. Let's listen to the flirtations and veiled threats as Bond and Fiona mark out their territory.
Have you been here before, Mr. Bond?
No, I haven't. But this is the road to Nassau.
Yes. Eventually.
Yes, me too. This is my hotel.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, it's so convenient.
You look pale, Mr. Bond. I hope I didn't frighten you.
Well, you see, I've always been a nervous passenger.
Some men just don't like to be driven.
No, some men just don't like to be taken for a ride. Look at this. An underwater hatch.
Yeah. So that's how they could leave and get back.
Yes, and nobody saw them. Obviously, the whole operation was carried out underwater. So that's where we'll have to look for the plane. Come on, Felix.
I'll bring the prints to the hotel when they're dry.
These shots were filmed by a special aerial unit, which was also used to look for certain locations. The shots of Bond and Leiter in the helicopter were filmed with the helicopter on a platform at the Nassau airport. These shots caused problems later on because of changes during the editing process. First, Bond and Leiter were only shot facing one direction, but later, editor Peter Hunt wished to have the cast members looking the other way to match shots filmed by the aerial unit. To achieve this, editor Hunt flipped the film. You can tell by watching the part in Sean Connery's hair, and by the fact that Felix Leiter would have to be flying the helicopter from the other side of the cockpit, where there are no controls. Also, since Bond and Leiter travel out twice in the helicopter, there were costume changes for the actors. Again, in the editing, Peter Hunt found he needed to use shots from both scenes, and thus a careful viewer can see that Felix Leiter's pants go from short pants to long pants in the later scene when Bond and Felix actually find the Vulcan bomber. But this only becomes noticeable on repeat viewings. While many might identify these as continuity problems, they are actually skillfully made edits. With a film of such gargantuan scale and tight schedule as Thunderball, and with up to 4 units shooting at a time, recreating a scene for reshoots can be prohibitively expensive. An expert editor can save filmmakers hundreds of thousands of dollars by carefully transposing unrelated bits of film to complete a scene. Filmmakers did their best to cover every aspect of production. Adolfo Celli and Luciano Paluzzi were trained by a skeet shooting expert before filming these scenes. Back to the Sullivan estate at Rock Point in Nassau. When the filmmakers asked to shoot around the outside of the house, Mr. Nicholas Sullivan agreed with the understanding that the inside of the house would not be needed. Nonetheless, Terrence Young and his crew were surprised to find the Sullivans intended to stay at their house even during the disruptive process of filming, which included a few all-night shoots. In fact, the Sullivans treated the film crew like they were cocktail party entertainment. Friends were invited over, lawn chairs were set up, and the homeowners would serve up drinks and watch the actors and crew work. The main concern of the crew was in the late hours, when some of the onlookers, who had consumed their share of liquor, would totter over to examine the shark pool. A few of the crew remember holding their breath while unsteady locals would lean over the swimming sharks. Fortunately, no one ever fell in. This scene, where Bond arrives and meets Largo, is a staple of the Bond films. From Dr. No's elegant dinner to golfing with Goldfinger, James Bond must meet the villain in a polite setting where a game of wits and class plays out. Bond never loses his cool on the villain's turf and always one-ups his nemesis. Here Bond openly flirts with Domino and blasts a clay pigeon out of the sky, shooting from the hip. The scene also plays a purpose in the plot, although we've almost lost track of the stolen atom bombs by now. Largo and Bond are trapped in an odd game of cat and mouse. Largo wants to invite Bond to his house, so that Bond can see that the atom bombs are not present. Bond and the British Secret Service cannot arrest Largo without the bombs, so the two men circle each other, politely waiting for one false move. To continue this theme, Terrence Young shot a scene where Bond is given a tour of the Disco Volante, which was to follow this scene. On board, Bond was to continue to check his Geiger counter watch, discovering the atom bombs were not present. Largo's introduction of Vargas and Gianni is an example of how a great screenwriter can translate something from a novel and make it work in a totally different context in a film. In the novel Thunderball, Fleming has Bond note that none of the men on the Disco Volante smoke or drink, noting how they must be disciplined professionals. Of course, it is hard to show characters not doing things in a film, so Richard Maybaum turned this conceptual passage into a wonderful bit of villainous dialogue, which Philip Locke, as Vargas, punctuates with just the right amount of shame. Speaking of Philip Locke, he too worked on many of the British-based television spy shows of the 60s and has had a diverse career in films from 1958's Heart of the Child to 1994's Turner Network movie Jacob, a Bible Story. He is probably best remembered by television audiences for 1982's faithful adaptation of Oliver Twist, where Locke played Mr. Sowerberry. In early drafts of the script, Largo was to consider pushing Bond in the shark pool during this encounter, but stops when Domino calls them for lunch. This moment is stronger. The practical plot is not advanced. James Bond is no closer to finding the atom bombs, but the emotional plot has moved forward. When Domino tells Bond that the conch chowder smells delicious, we know that Bond has found a way to break Largo. Now Bond must find a way to make Domino understand why she must turn against the man.
Yes, I would very much.
Emilio, lunch is ready.
Thank you, my darling.
Come along, Mr. Bond. The conch chowder smells delicious.
Domino, yes? I was just thinking, as I'll be busy this evening, perhaps Mr. Bond will be kind enough to take you to the Junk Canoe. It's our local Mardi Gras. You'll be my guest tonight, Mr. Bond.
Well, that's very kind of you.
It will be my pleasure.
Back at Coral Harbor, or at least a fanciful Ken Adams set of what a Coral Harbor suite for the very rich might look like, it is time to introduce Martine Beswick before she disappears from the film. Beswick, a native Jamaican, appeared in 2 of the first 4 Bond films. She met Terrence Young through a location scout and friend, Chris Blackwell,
and she auditioned for the part of Honey Rider in Dr. No. Young told her to go get some acting experience and that he would put her in some other film. This was all the encouragement Martine needed. She sold her car and moved to London, where she took acting lessons. True to his word, Terence Young gave Martine the role of one of the fighting gypsy women in From Russia with Love. Later, after much pestering, the producers relented and allowed Young to cast her in Thunderball. After Thunderball, Martine appeared in two cavewoman films, 1 Million Years B.C. and Prehistoric Women. In the early 1970s, Beswick appeared in some wonderfully campy roles, which have endeared her to a new generation of filmmakers. 1972's Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde has long been a cult favorite. 1974's Seizure has many notable elements. First, it is Oliver Stone's directorial debut, and second, Martine co-stars with future Bond villain, the late Hervé Villechaize. In Stone's film, Beswick plays the role credited simply as the Queen of Evil. More recently, Martine Beswick has appeared in the films The Miami Blues and Wide Sargasso Sea, among others. As Bond breaks into Largo's estate to find Paula, let's take a look at the men who brought the Bond series to the screen. First, Harry Saltzman, who purchased an option on the Bond novels. Saltzman had the remarkable fortune to be involved in many different genres of film. Born in New Brunswick in 1915, he started in vaudeville in Canada and then toured shows in France. During World War II, Harry Saltzman was a translator for Allied generals. In 1956, Saltzman formed Woodfall Films with noted British playwright John Osborne and director Tony Richardson. The trio made three films together, all noted for their hard-hitting drama, Look Back in Anger, The Entertainer, and Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. These films were considered wonderful, realistic dramas, so it was unusual that Saltzman would turn to James Bond. But Saltzman felt audiences were tiring of depressing kitchen sink dramas, and thus Saltzman tried to take an option on 007. In spite of Bond's immense success, Saltzman was always looking for new things. He produced the Harry Palmer series for a while, known as The Thinking Man's Bond. In 1969, he produced the ambitious Battle of Britain with Guy Hamilton at the helm. In 1973, he helped finance an Italian film, Days of Fury. In 1975, Saltzman sold his share of Danjak to United Artists. Danjak is the company which he formed with Albert R. Broccoli to hold the film rights to the James Bond novels. Saltzman attempted many ventures after the Bonds, purchasing a large share of Technicolor and working in French film exhibition. He moved to Paris, where he helped secure financing for foreign films. The last film to carry his producer credit was 1989's acclaimed Yugoslavian film, Time of the Gypsies. Harry Saltzman passed away in September of 1994. At the time of Thunderball, Saltzman was one of the most powerful film producers in the world. By the time of his death, he had removed himself so far from Hollywood that his passing was barely noticed. Albert R. Broccoli, known to his friends as Cubby Broccoli, took quite a different journey with James Bond. Cubby Broccoli was born on Long Island and worked his way up in the film industry. He was an assistant director on The Outlaw, which was directed mostly by Howard Hawks, although credited to Howard Hughes. His experience on the set, and after World War II as an agent, taught Broccoli how to spot talent. Broccoli moved to England in the early 1950s and formed a company with an experienced director-producer, Irving Allen. They called the company Warwick Films. England was a land of opportunity for independence in the 50s and 60s because of a rule requiring film studios to spend a portion of their profits on British soil. This meant every major American film studio had money which had to be spent on British films. By finding an American star like Alan Ladd or Richard Widmark and pulling together a crack team of British talent to make the film, Broccoli and Allen became successful and prolific. After the highly successful Fire Down Below with Robert Mitchum, Jack Lemmon, and Rita Hayworth, Broccoli looked into picking up the James Bond novels for Warwick. The idea did not fly with Broccoli's partner, Allen, but after the breakup of Warwick, Broccoli decided to go after 007 again. This time he discovered through a mutual friend, screenwriter Wolf Mankiewicz, that Harry Saltzman had the option, but very little time. Broccoli first offered to buy Saltzman out, but eventually agreed to a partnership. Thus began the long, sometimes rocky, but always fruitful relationship of Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. After Dr. No, Broccoli produced two non-Bond films, the Bob Hope comedy Call Me Buona which he produced with Harry Saltzman, and Ian Fleming's children's story, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. His string of James Bond successes earned him the Irving Thalberg Award from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in 1982. At the height of Bond mania, Broccoli's old partner, Irving Allen, produced the James Bond spoofing Matt Helm series, starring Dean Martin, and later the very different Matt Helm television series. Another side note on Broccoli. When he was an agent in Hollywood, he worked for Charles K. Feldman, who later produced the James Bond comedy Casino Royale in 1967. Under Broccoli's supervision, the James Bond films have become, and remain, the most successful and watched film series ever. Another person who contributed to that success is screenwriter Richard Maybaum. Maybaum got his start by writing a play about lynching, which was produced on Broadway. Shortly after coming to Hollywood, he found a niche for writing thrillers and war films, most notably Alfred Hitchcock's James Bond precursor, Foreign Correspondent, in 1940. In 1953, Maybaum started his association with Broccoli, writing the script for Paratrooper, Broccoli's first Warwick film. One of Maybaum's greatest skills was stitching together diverse plot elements into a satisfying story. He proved this time and time again on the Bond films by tightening and improving Fleming's plots. In Thunderball, for example, Maybaum seems to know exactly how to keep the delicate balance between Bond and Largo throughout the film, creating confrontations at night or underwater, where Largo cannot actually see Bond's face. Maybaum also came up with Bond's reason to travel to Nassau. In the novel, Bond does not see Domino's brother dead at Shrublands. Also, Maybaum has Largo know full and well that the NATO pilot he had killed was Domino's brother. In Fleming's novel, Largo can't even remember the pilot's last name and is totally unaware that he is having an affair with the pilot's sister. It is these sorts of touches which made the Bond film so engaging as stories. Richard Maybaum passed away in 1992. Back to the film and two of the stars. This scene is a perfect showcase for 007. James Bond has just returned from finding Paula dead and many near misses with hungry sharks, yet Director Young does not take time to dwell on Bond's anger or frustration. Instead, Bond is ready for a little rest and relaxation with Luciana Paluzzi, who explains the chemistry and erotic elements of these scenes.
I still think that there is much more sexuality in somebody that is totally dressed than somebody that is totally naked. I mean, so at the time, going back 30 years, because you couldn't take your clothes off, what happened is that you had to express it even more with the way you were talking, with your eyes, with the gestures, and because you couldn't just go like this. You had to do something that was just as erotic as it is in being naked, and so they were more erotic that way.
You'll catch your death of cold.
Now look, you know we're going to be too late.
Too late for what?
The junk canoe. I promised my friends I'd meet. Perhaps you know them, the Largos.
The press was invited to the set during the bedroom scene rehearsals between Luciana Paluzzi and Connery, resulting in much worldwide publicity. The angle Terrence Young filmed this scene from is a perfect example of Luciana Paluzzi's concept of how to make a scene erotic. Here, her fingers on the bed tell all. The cutaway during the lovemaking is always a favorite moment for a film editor. Hitchcock's ending of North by Northwest is probably the most famous, with the train entering a tunnel. Here, Peter Hunt throws in a little visual metaphor.
You made a shocking mess out of my hair, you sadistic brute.
Luciana Paluzzi's lines, after their quick romp, are particularly worth noting because they are taken in part from critiques of James Bond. When Fiona calls Bond a sadistic brute for mussing her hair, she mocks the oversensitive critics who were morally outraged by 007's behavior. When she taunts Bond, saying that James Bond only has to make love to a woman, and she hears heavenly choir singing, she is virtually quoting from some of the few poor reviews Goldfinger received. There were those who felt Pussy Galore's transformation from lesbian villain to heroine was a little much.
Writers Maybaum and Hopkins decided to have a little fun with the concept. Few filmmakers get to thumb their nose at critics, but this scene in Thunderball does it in style, and the writing and acting is so good the actors never leave character, and the scene remains tense and witty.
Vanity has its dangers.
Vanity, Mr. Bond? Something you know so much about.
My dear girl, don't flatter yourself. What I did this evening was for King and Country. You don't think it gave me any pleasure, do you?
But of course, I forgot your ego, Mr. Bond. James Bond, who only has to make love to a woman, and she starts to hear heavenly choir singing. She repents it and immediately returns to the side of right and virtue. But not this one. What a blow it must have been.
Originally, in earlier scripts, Bond was to be dressed in a colorful Junkanoo costume as Paluzzi and Largo's henchmen led him away from the hotel. Bond was to get away by starting a fire on a room service cart. The concept of James Bond in a Junkanoo outfit was thankfully dropped, and this version, with a live explosion in a Ford station wagon, replaces it. George Leach and Cliff Cully remember.
That's a Junkanoo, isn't it? All the noise and the floats going by. The cars get held up here. That's me on the right there, I think. I thought, yes, I was on his right.
That's you.
Oh, I see. I'm in the front of the car. Oh, I thought I was at his... There's the guy with the bottle. Close up of the bottle. She's lighting a cigarette. The guy says, have a drink. He kicks the bottle. It goes over the car and me. He sets fire to it with the lady's lighter.
That's your arm.
I'm out with the arm, a light. There he is.
A lot of noise going on. And we couldn't really see Bond. We were just going through and diving in and out the things. Everyone was enjoying themselves, singing and shouting. It was a great evening. Very tiring because it went on practically all night. Thomas Young, I think he was fed up with the noise after a while. It was driving him mad because it was going on all night long. And it was just a thump and a bang and shouting and banging, cymbals and drums and God knows what else. And he just wanted the thing to go round and round while they were shooting various pieces. And rather than stop everybody, it would have taken such a long time to get it all together again. He just kept them going around and around this particular area.
The Junkanoo is one of those incredibly difficult shoots for a director. The parade was created by offering a prize for the most elaborate costume and floats from a local charity organization. The local population came through in droves, but the parade marchers were totally unfamiliar with filmmaking. Rather than risk the parade marchers burning out through boredom, Terrence Young had them march continuously around a block in downtown Nassau. Young and his second unit crews, led by Peter Hunt, had shot lists, which they tried to fill as best they could. For two nights, the Junkanoo roared in Nassau, and even after that, there were some shots which had to be filmed a few weeks later. Chase scenes, where the pursuit escapes into a crowd, are as old as films themselves, but the elaborate chaos portrayed here gives the scene extra urgency, as do the handheld camera shots in John Barry music, which, with its whistles, fits right in with the parade noise. Also, note that the parade doesn't allow Bond to escape his pursuers, unlike most of these chase scenes, including the notable homage to the Junkanoo scene in 1993's Harrison Ford thriller, The Fugitive. Peter Hunt and Terrence Young also throw in a wonderful tag, with Bond bolting in shock for the first time in the film series. The filmmakers built the club Bond escapes to because there were no locations with the appropriate atmosphere. By the time the club was completed, many locals wanted it to remain as a permanent establishment. Originally, it was to be named the Jump Jump Club, after the Caribbean style of music. One of Terrence Young's lasting contributions on Thunderball was his relationship with so many who worked on the film. His personal touch with the performers and style of directing, while always encouraging, made many lifelong friends, as Luciana Paluzzi remembers.
He was my... he gave me away when I got married the second time. He flew in from Rome, especially came into New York for the weekend. He was shooting a picture. And you know how tough it is when you're working. You can't just take an aeroplane and go away Saturday and Sunday. And he did that because my father was already dead, and he wanted to give me away to my husband, Michael. And I never forget that. He was such a generous man. I mean, he would take off his shirt to give it to anybody. He was the one that helped the sons of people that were friends of his who were in trouble. He was a very generous, loving man. And I miss him a lot. I mean, I used to see him a lot when he had his villa now in France, and I go there 3 times a year. So there was not a time where I would go and I wouldn't go and say hi to him, because he was like my dad. I mean, I had Roger and Sean here one night for dinner, and they couldn't find one thing nasty to say about Terence. Everything was so positive. A very giving, loving man. And I think he did also some really terrific films. And the Bond pictures were a style on their own.
Terence Young.
I thought the person who came out awfully well in that picture was Luciana Paluzzi. And she was very lucky because she had a baddie is always a much more fascinating character than a goodie in any country. I mean, that's how Bogey made his career. But there were a couple of charming sequences. I thought the bedroom scene with her, the sex scenes with her, and between her and Bond were delightful. And I loved the scene where she gets killed. And I thought she came out very well in the picture. I liked her scenes very much.
The killing of Fiona proved to be such an audience-pleasing scene that it was lifted for the first James Coburn Flint movie, Our Man Flint. And later, Mark Lester paid homage to the scene in the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, Commando. John Barry's contribution to the first 4 Bond films cannot be overstated. Barry came in after Monty Norman completed the score on Dr. No, reworking portions. With From Rush with Love and Goldfinger, Barry became one of the most sought-after film composers working. With Thunderball, Barry faced special challenges in having the title song changed on him at the last minute.
Thunderball is probably the worst title you could possibly... I mean, what does it mean, for Christ's sake, you know, in terms of the lyricist sitting down and saying, you know, what am I going to do? I remember Tony Newley said, Thunderball, marvellous. So I was flying from London to Los Angeles and reading some magazine, and the Italians nicknamed James Bond Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And it's a great title. You don't get a title like Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you know, that you can use. And I said that we can redefine Bond, you know, through the lyric, through that title. So we did that. Leslie Bricus wrote the lyric. I liked it. Dionne Warwick sang it. And it was a 3-4, and I had cowbells and all kinds. It was a very strange... Again, a strange piece, but I liked it. Because we'd had success with the actual song titles, they were afraid of having a Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang when the movie's Thunderbolt, and so they said at the last minute, look, we want to use the title Thunderbolt. So, Don Black came in. Again, this was done maniacally over a weekend, because it was like a last-minute phone call. They were all going to go with the Dionne Warwick thing. And then it was like, no, we've got to change. Again, in choosing Tom Jones, that was also very important. And again, because Tom sings with great conviction. He doesn't ask too many questions. You know, hey, where are you going? So, yeah, go, you know. So getting Tom Jones to sing that song was a good choice. Another singer... asking any questions, forget it. He almost passed out on that last note on the podium when he was singing to playback, because he holds that long note and he sings full bloodedly, you know.
Riku Browning discusses the discovery of the Vulcan.
For some of the sequences when we were tied into shooting sharks on the surface, we wouldn't fool with the sharks because it took so long to get a shark to actually come up and swim on the surface that we would just have a man swimming with a fin. And the fins would be in the foreground, the set would be in the background, or the people would be in the background. The shot of the Vulcan bomber when it was on the bottom with this camouflage netting over it, particularly on a day when the water was a little bit hazy and the sharks were swimming around, it was so very weird and realistic looking. It was as if the bomber had actually crashed and they had actually done what was supposed to be done. It was a very, very well done set. I would say about 15 sharks we were using on and off. And several of the sharks got away. We weren't able to contain them because you have to let them look like they're free-swimming sharks. And you can't always re-catch them. They build up too much steam and you can't swim fast enough to get them. But a funny story in this one was we were getting ready to shoot Bond going up into the bomb bay, and I said to Big John, I said, John, get the biggest shark we've got and put him up in the bomb bay. And when Bond swims up, we'll let him go and he'll come out and Bond will go in. And John went over and came back up and he said, Rico, he says, the shark won't fit. I said, what are you talking about? He says, the shark is too big to put in the bomb bay. And I said, he says, he's 14 feet long, a little over 14 feet long. And I said, well, put his tail in the cockpit. And he said, okay. So they did. And so the shark you see in that sequence is the 14-footer coming out of the bomb bay. But he was so big, you know, wide-bodied and long to fit in that bomb bay that they had to put his tail in the cockpit in order for him to come out. The Vulcan bomber, when we finished using it, they wanted to destroy it because they didn't want anyone else to photograph it. So we took primer cord and wrapped the entire bomber with primer cord and a few small sticks of dynamite. And we set off the charges and just blew it to pieces. And then when you went down, all that was left was this framework that it was built on. And over the years, it became a reef. The sequence with Sean and Claudine Auger swimming towards each other, like running through a field of flowers to embrace and swimming up into the sun and then sinking, and to have a little hanky-panky going on behind a coral reef. As soon as they sank behind the coral reef, we had a tank and a guy under there, and he opened it up and then just flooded the screen with bubbles to figure something's going on. And as I recall, we shot the scene several different ways, letting perhaps a bikini top go up in through the bubbles. But in editing, they chose not to use that.
Bond's confrontation with Domino proved to be a difficult and crucial sequence. It was filmed on Love Beach in Nassau and was one of the first scenes shot when the crew arrived. Ultimately, portions had to be reshot on a soundstage at Pinewood Studios. This scene provides closure to Domino and Bond's exchange at their first meeting. What sharp little eyes you've got, Domino comments, and it is Bond's sharp eyes that spots the camouflage Vulcan and her brother's dog tags. Wait till you get to my teeth, Bond says to himself as she walks away. Not only is there a literal translation of Bond biting Domino's foot to suck out the sea egg spines, but also as Bond hurts her by revealing the truth to her. Director Young knew that after all the elegance and bravado, that James Bond must show some humanity in this scene. But Young, Editor Hunt, and Sean Connery make some interesting choices. Rather than have Bond misty-eyed at Domino's pain, Bond puts on sunglasses that prevent her from seeing his eyes. A simple shot of Bond's hand shaking as she takes the small possessions of her brother let us know Bond's emotions. She, too, tries to mask her emotions, brushing her hair when she thinks Bond is breaking up with her. Ultimately, the scene reveals more about Bond by showing the emotions he hides than by trying to explore those emotions on screen. With a few well-stated lines, Connery brings us back to our central story and sets up the last climactic act.
He's dead. What happened?
It's a long story, and it involves your friend, Largo.
Thank you.
Domino, I need your help.
Of course. That's why you made love to me.
Look, I can't explain what this is all about. But you must trust me.
Because you want me to help you.
Look, Largo had your brother murdered, or it was on his orders.
Thousands, hundreds of thousands.
Terrence Young left Thunderball during the post-production to begin work on another Ian Fleming-inspired film, this time for the United Nations. It's called The Poppy Is Also a Flower. Most video releases have it titled as The Opium Connection. The film was originally shown on U.S. television and demonstrates all of Terrence Young's directing skills. The film is also, obviously, trying to be as Bondian as possible. Young even films an elaborate train fight, which is almost as exciting as the one in From Russia with Love. When Young left Thunderball, the film was turned over to Peter Hunt to complete editing and supervise all aspects of post-production. Peter Hunt was certainly up for the challenge, as Terrence Young recalls.
With too much underwater stuff, and also your whole problem that in a Bond film is preventing the audience from asking questions. In Dr. No, as I said, we invented almost new forms of editing by cutting into panning shots, into tracks, everything that the editing faculties always said you could never possibly do. And in fact, my own editor, Peter Hunt, who was, I think, a wonderful editor, and he learned more on that picture than he learned in his life. And eventually, when we were cutting the other pictures, it was I who kept saying, look, we can't do that. And he'd say, look, who's talking, you know. But I had only one aim in Dr. No. The basic plot of Dr. No is something for a boy's comic paper or for a monogram, Republic production, you know. But by giving it a sort of surface gloss and a certain sleek style and a lot of luxury, the eye was dazzled, and by the speed of the technical presentation of the picture and its editing and its shooting, I think contrived to arrive at a situation where the public, only on their way home in a car, said, now, how the hell did Dr. No's doctor find out that this had happened, and how was he there at this time, you see? Well, things like that is fine when the people are asking the questions several hours later. It doesn't matter.
As Bond joins the Spectre Frogmen, we should meet one of the most neglected men of the creative team for the early Bond films, Ted Moore, the cinematographer. Moore was responsible for the crisp, clean look of the Bond films, the use of wide angles, deep focus, and luxuriously saturated colors. Terrence Young used to say that Ted Moore made the Bond films look American, but he did more. He made the Bond films look worldly, visually simple, but interesting. His clear images allowed Peter Hunt to push the envelope with editing, because you could always see what was going on. Moore was born in South Africa in 1914 and worked with the RAF Film Group during the war. He worked as a camera operator on John Huston's The African Queen and moved to director of photography on A Prize of Gold, a Warwick film. He continued to work steadily for producer Broccoli and others, including Terrence Young on Zarek and Ken Adam on The Trials of Oscar Wilde. Ted Moore won an Academy Award for his work on A Man for All Seasons. In the 1970s, he filmed two Sinbad pictures for Ray Harryhausen. His last Bond film was The Man with the Golden Gun, which he co-shot with cinematographer Oswald Morris. A minor note, if you will notice, Bond continually checks his watch during the film. Almost always, it is his Geiger counter watch from Q Branch. In this scene, it is a smaller Rolex. Later, when Bond is in a wetsuit aboard the Disco, the watch is back to the larger Geiger counter version. Now to portions of the film that Ted Moore did not shoot, the undersea segments, filmed by Lamar Bourne and, to a lesser extent, Jordan Klein. Riku Browning remembers shooting these scenes.
Some of the locations that we filmed, we used them because they looked real good. And when these gentlemen lined up on a seawall, as an example, to jump in, you're only in about 2.5 feet of water. So when they jump in, they had to be very careful and then just sink. But underwater, we move somewhere and re-jump them so that they had plenty of depth and clarity in order to swim. So we had to change our locations frequently to fit the script. I wasn't present during much of the topside shooting, but I was present during some of it. And the English crew and Terrence Young had a pretty difficult time some days, because the weather got pretty bad, and it was kind of
heartbreaking to see them sitting around and not able to shoot, but they kept trying until they got it done.
Once we pick up the merchandise, head for our target area, Miami.
The disc of Valente is leaving, sir.
When we worked in the ocean, we could work in a little rougher water because when we go down, you're not completely aware of the rough sea above you, except when you're putting gear in the water or taking it out. That's where you have your big problem with a crane. If you lift something, it swings and hits the boat. When you're climbing in and out of the water, you can get hurt by the dive ladder cramming into you from rough seas. But when you're actually in working, it's not so bad. The area where we were hiding the atomic bombs was in the Exuma chain, and we found a cave. I think actually Kevin McClory had found this cave and told us about it, and I went down and scouted it, and we had to put a doorway in the cave opening to have it open so that the submarine could go in, and they proceeded to hide the bombs. Well, we actually put this swinging door way in the cave, but when the currents were so terrific, when the tide went in and out, that twice it ripped the doors out before we could film them. And we wound up putting the doors in, staying up all night while the tide was right in order to do the sequence, and we filmed just about filmed or worked both just about all night long just to get that one sequence of the doors opening and the sub going in and also the sub going out and the doors closing. The rest of it, once we were in the cave, of course, we weren't shooting towards the doors, and everything worked pretty smoothly. The apparatuses which the British crew had designed worked perfectly for offloading and loading the bombs. We had another sequence where we had a fight, and we'd sit around the table on the boat, and different guys in the crew would come up with ideas for how to kill somebody or mangle them or hit them or whatever. And I just said, well, we've got enough fight sequences in this show that we can use everybody's ideas, so keep coming up with them. I don't have them all. So a lot of the ideas of people fighting were from different crew members, as well as my own, and some that were scripted. The cave door was probably in about 3 feet of water at high tide. At low tide, you've probably got a little air showing, just a little bit. It's a beautiful cave. Once you're inside, you can look up, and there are holes up in the ceiling. And the sun rays, I wish we could have filmed it, the sun rays coming down through the holes. It was very, very unique looking. It was very beautiful. We used magnesium flares, and we used to use them in Sea Hunt years ago. And recalling that, you couldn't buy them anymore in the States, so the British made those up, and they work beautifully. They don't last too long, but they really light up an area. You have to be careful. They burn you pretty badly if you're not careful.
Even though at this point in the film, Bond is at his lowest, defeated and trapped in an underwater cave, the viewer knows 007 is not in real danger. We expect Bond to prevail, and we are only interested in seeing how this will happen. The audience's emotional interest lies on the Disco Volante, where the danger to Domino seems palpable. This scene of Domino's capture and the later scene of her being tortured are both from Fleming's novel. By cross-cutting between Domino and Largo, and Bond searching for a way out of the cave, the filmmakers set up the expectation that Bond will be able to save Domino at the moment she needs him the most. This is clever deception in the writing and editing because it makes Bond's inability to save Domino more emotional while also making Largo more ominous as a villain.
Mr. Bond gave you this little toy, I imagine. Vargas is dead.
Rico Browning discusses the physics of filming Bond's rescue.
This cave really didn't have an area to surface, so we changed locations when Bond came up to the surface in the area where they hid the bombs, and surfaced actually in a cave at the west end of Nassau, and it was about 2 feet of water he laid down in and then just climbed up on a ledge. Actually, there was a hole here looking up where you could see sky, because later they come in with a helicopter to pick him up. And we switched to another location for lifting him up, which was just a small island, and we just put him on the back side of the island to look like he's coming up out of a hole. So we actually used 3 to 4 different locations just to get that one sequence.
Note the set of Ken Adams coming up here of Domino's stateroom with its mirrored surfaces. Adam and director Young used these to allow the camera to see Largo in distorted reflections and double images, emphasizing his villainy and duplicitous nature. While director Young tells his story in a straightforward visual fashion, these little touches show that he knows exactly what he is doing, saving his visual trickery for just the right moment. Terrence Young knew the action scenes would be Thunderball's showcase, and that it would be important to stick to the basics during the film's dramatic scenes. Otherwise, the emotional arc of the story would be lost amongst the hardware and fighting. Once again, director Young has some fun with the dialogue here. Largo tells Domino, "There is no one to rescue you." Then, Peter Hunt cuts to Bond, again setting up that Bond's goal is to rescue Domino rather than stop an atomic bomb from going off. We are now about to enter the climax of our story. Bond has confirmed that Largo has the bombs and knows the target is Miami. The only thing left is for Bond to stop Largo. All the games are over, and now the battle must begin. The concept of a huge underwater battle was included in Fleming's original novel and was discussed by Fleming and Kevin McClory even earlier. It proved to be a wonderful idea. Ian Fleming loved to snorkel and scuba dive and wrote hauntingly about the undersea world. In fact, Fleming was friends with Jacques Cousteau and covered some of Cousteau's adventures for the London Sunday Times. For filmmakers, there could be no greater challenge than filming a giant underwater battle. The script for the battle was only 1 page long, with vague descriptions. It was up to Rico Browning and his crew to come up with enough action to fill the screen.
Target is Miami. Also, the bomb is transferred from the Disco Volante onto a wreck off Bowie Point.
Right, hang on to that.
Underwater director, Rico Browning.
The good guys, the parachuters, jumped out of the airplane, was shot in Miami, and we used paramedics for the shot. And they had never jumped out of an airplane with swim fins. So it was the first time, and they jumped out with swim fins and landed in the water near the Miami Seaquarium over in the bay. You can see Miami in the background where the men are jumping out of the aircraft. And we had the underwater, of course, we switched to the divers and we jumped them off a barge, you know, into the water and released themselves from parachutes. And then we took a license and put parachutes all over the bottom to look, you know, just colorful.
Thank you.
But in the fighting sequence, we hired, I forget how many men on each side, but it seemed to me it was 20 or 25 or something. And they were all from dive clubs and inexperienced. And we had to get them in a formation swimming down to fight, and the others swimming up to fight. And they didn't weight themselves properly, and when they didn't, they would take the weights off in the middle of the shot. And the cameraman and I are underwater, and we're being rained down with lead weights coming down until we got everything ironed out and they got weighted properly, and we were able to shoot the shots of the fight. And as I told you, the guns in the battle sequence were real. We put rubber tips on the end of the spears, and we put new notches in the spears so that they wouldn't be so powerful, for the rubbers not to be so powerful. Still, in close range, you could get hurt if you got hit by one. In one fight sequence, I participated also in some of the scene, and we were fighting on board ship later on in this sequence, and I fell with a guy fighting, and I fell on a spear and stuck it in my leg, and went to the hospital, and they pulled it out, and I was fine. It wasn't that serious. The sequence where Bond is going to help the good guys in the fight, the package that he had to wear, Jordan designed it, but it became so bulky it was very difficult to use, and the propeller wasn't powerful enough to push him through the water very fast. So we put him on a piano wire, and we could move him through the water pretty good. And we put dye through the propeller, which gives it just a little more dramatic look, so that he could come into the fight looking like the cavalry has arrived. John McLaughlin, who doubled Alpha, did an excellent job in this sequence. He looked bigger than life and was fighting all these guys and tearing them apart. It was difficult shooting these scenes, only in that you couldn't just have a guy get shot or fight. You had to have background fights going on while the one fight was going on. And you just had to redo and redo and redo. And one of the shots where Sean comes in with his apparatus and bends over and shoots one of the bad guys in the chest, the boy that got shot was Courtney Brown. He used to double Lloyd Bridges in Sea Hunt, one of our best swimmers. It hit him in the chest and exploded, and what happened was we had magnesium ball on his chest on it, under his wetsuit, which was seared so it would break open, and we put a fiberglass vest under his wetsuit so that it would protect his body. However, something we didn't think about was when the magnesium goes off, it releases tremendous forces of gas. And the gas couldn't all get out of his wetsuit, so it went under the wetsuit and around to his back. And it was so hot, it just seared his whole backside and under his arm. And we didn't, any of us, realize he was hurt. We thought he was acting. And then when the scene was over, he was still pretty crumpled up. We got him to the surface and could see, you know, he was burned badly. And it was a very serious burn. We took him to the hospital. And he had just these huge bubbles, blisters on him. And it took a while for him to get well, but he got well enough that he helped us shoot some more later on. Some of the things in this sequence were not scripted in the sense that when you saw the set underwater, you just ad-libbed, and when you saw something that looked like it could work, you used it, like that hatch falling on people. I got the bright idea for the ending, and it really saved the sequence, I think, is when the explosion goes off, you see the bubbles, and then you see this one swim fin floating up in the bubbles. It kind of made the sequence. When Bond was fighting towards the end of the show, he was using the little breathing device, and he had to hold his breath. So Frank had to do a lot of breath holding, and as soon as the scene was over, of course, someone would swim in with a mouthpiece and give him some air, or he would swim off stage in the sequence and get air before we'd start another sequence. And it looks like he holds his breath for a good 15 minutes or so. But you take a little
artistic license, and it looks good and works fine. As I said, we tried every trick we could think of, as cutting an air hose, breaking a mask, stabbing a guy, shooting him in the arm, shooting the air hose off, cutting to eels on the bottom with a knife falling on them, or a crawfish swimming, or a shark swimming in and one of the men shooting the shark. And we had a ball shooting the sequence. It was a lot of fun.
Composer John Barry.
The action sequences, I would take a day without even writing a note, just with a manuscript paper, say for a 2.5 minute action sequence, just looking at the film and saying, here, this is going to hit here, this is going to hit there, we go down here. Just absolutely mapping out a structural line before I got down to writing the music, what had to happen, and I'd make these funny little remarks above it. That would take a day, sometimes a day and a half, without music. And then once I had that like graph, if you like, of what was going to happen, then I'd sit and compose to that graph, knowing where the heights were, knowing where I had to hit. So it was a lot of work.
Underwater director Rico Browning.
In the sequence where the shark gets shot, I think the guys were worried because he came in pretty close. And I don't know that it was scripted for him to shoot the shark, but when he turned, I think he shot the shark. We used a lot of show business blood in this sequence. And you use some gimmicks of trying to make the blood stick to knife blades and that sort of thing. We tried to work in 30 feet as much as possible because you can work all day long. Once you get below 30 feet, you have to start worrying about repetitive dives and bends and all baloney. So you've got enough problems with having that as an extra problem. But when we were working around the airplane wreck, we were working in a little deeper water, and we had to be very careful about our times. And as you can see in some of these sequences, the sun ripples on the bottom, so you know you're fairly close to the surface. When you can't see the ripples, you know you're a lot deeper. And also the bubbles flow up a little differently from deep water than they do from shallow water.
Terence Young talks about working with Barry.
John Barry, he is incredibly professional, has got a tremendous smell for the type of music. I mean, at various times, I've wanted something different. And he said, will you let me try it this way? And then if you don't like it, I'll do what you want. And with one or two exceptions, I've always been able to say, look, I'm completely wrong and you're completely right. John, let's use the other. And in my opinion, one of the best film musicians. He has a feeling for celluloid. He knows sometimes where film should be and where it should not, where music should be and where it should not be, you know. I think he's a very, very gifted person. It's a funny thing. Very often, somebody who writes, important scoring, that the music is very heavy and all that, very often it can be distracting. But in John's cases, I'd have said nearly always, they are helpful, they add to the mood, they add to the excitement of a sequence.
At the end of the story, the filmmakers have saved one last dramatic twist. Although Bond has been cast in the role of St. George, he must kill the dragon and save the damsel. Here it is the damsel who saves Bond. Domino, like most of the early Bond women, is certainly portrayed as a sexual object in a man's world. But she is also written as a character who ultimately has the ability to take decisive action and to stand on her own. She is not saved by Bond, but in a more interesting twist, because of the information Bond gives her, she finds the strength to save herself. Of course, the filmmakers present this in a way that does not diminish Bond's stature as a hero. For after this naval battle, we are about to see one of the most visceral fights ever filmed. Director Terence Young tries to build on the climactic fight in From Russia with Love, which pitted Bond against Red Grant in a small train compartment on the Orient Express. Again, Bond must fight it out on a moving vehicle in tight quarters. Only this time, 007 must face more than one opponent. This battle royale was said to have inspired the fight scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where Indiana Jones tries to take control of a moving truck. More recently, Harrison Ford was in a similar scene created for the film Patriot Games, where, during the climax, Ford's character must battle a terrorist on a runaway speedboat in the Chesapeake Bay. Assistant stunt arranger George Leach remembers.
It's amazing how the tension and the excitement builds up when you think they're all shot apart, different places. That's Bob Simmons on the side of the boat climbing up on Disco Volante from the float, getting aboard the boat. That's Harold Sanderson. He's a captain. He gets beaten up, smashed by Sean Connery. I come in and give him a right-hander. I'm kicked off, thrown against the wall there. Dolfo Celli comes up. He's given a beating. I've got another whack. Harold Sanderson's got another whack. The poor stuntmen are going through it. Well, Connery was very professional. He did everything that he was asked to do. It was all the fight was rehearsed. And it was rehearsed with Bob Simmons in his place. And once it was all memorized and worked out, Sean Connery learned all his moves and went through accordingly. He never went off the script of a fight, because it's usually fatal. Somebody gets hurt if you do things ad-lib. You can ad-lib to a certain extent by grabbing hold of each other. If the routine's forgotten and you want to start it again without cutting the camera, you can whisper in each other's ears or grab each other again, throw each other apart and start again without anybody knowing that the routine's been interrupted.
Director Terence Young.
Well, again, we had to choreograph it because there weren't stuntmen. It was nearly, they did most of that fight themselves. There were one or two shots we had to do with the doubles because it was very difficult keeping your feet.
Glad I killed him.
You're glad.
Thunderball stands as a testament to dozens of film professionals. It had three producers, all of whom were very different men. The story was compiled from the work of at least five writers, two directors, with bits thrown in from many more participants. Thunderball is like all of the Bond films, a wonderful testament to the collaborative art of filmmaking. Terence Young remembers.
We had very experienced people like Dick Maybaum, you know, who's a great constructionist and I think he's one of the best people in the world, rather in the form of George Kaufman in the theater, taking something and pulling it together and seeing its defects and all that. But the gimmicks, some of them were already in the books themselves. The others, I think, were a combination of various people's ideas. Most of the technical things, because I'm basically totally disinterested in technical things. I mean, the last thing I'd ever want to do is to make 2001. You know, this would drive me up the wall. Although everybody thinks because of the James Bond gimmickry and all that, that I'm passionately devoted to it. And I get more science fiction scripts sent to me than I think anybody, except perhaps possibly poor Stanley Kubrick. But I'd have said it was a combination of various people's ideas and discussing things. And From Russia With Love, the helicopter idea was mine, but let's be honest, it had already been used in a different form by Hitchcock in North by Northwest. But on the whole, I'd have said some of them were the scriptwriter's inventions, some of them were special effects people brought in. The boat that split itself in two, for instance, in Thunderball was in the original book. The Aston Martin was in the original book. So, I mean, it's about 50-50. I'd have said that as director, every film I made, I decided how we were going to do it technically and how I wanted the models and the technical bits to be built and so on. That was my problem. but I cannot say that I lie awake at night thinking this will be a marvelous gimmick. That's not my bag at all.
We hope you've enjoyed this 30th anniversary special edition laser disc. We would like to thank Steve Morey for his interview with Terrence Young, taken on the set of 1974's film The Klansman, and we'd like to thank all those who participated and helped make this laser disc a reality.